Okay. We're going to get started now. Sorry for the little delay. Jim had fantastic remarks. I wish we had a little bit more time. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Heather, who's going to lead the discussion for this panel.
So it's an interesting sort of follow-on to the discussion that we just had in the other room with respect to e-commerce and the effect on commercial real estate. So let's start off with that as our initial theme, and I'd ask everyone on the panel just to sort of comment on how you're seeing the impact of e-commerce and online retail affecting your businesses. So we'll start with you, Neil.
Sure. Well, I think my name is Neil Doyle with DCT Industrial Trust. We're seeing a commerce impact, and I'm sure e-commerce is a big part of that. But leasing is up pretty much in every segment, in every city, in every size range. It's been a good year. It's a little hard to calculate what the e-commerce effect is there exactly, because I'm relatively certain that each one of our tenants is represented somehow, some way on the internet. So it's a little hard to nail that exactly, but the changes are probably in volatility, technology, location, parking, both for car and fleets. We've got some coverage issues these days that need to be addressed by the industrial developers. So it's a changing environment, but I would categorize it, certainly for us at least, as evolutionary, not revolutionary.
Over to you, Jen.
It's been very beneficial for us. We are a partner of Amazon, so we have done about 12 deals for Amazon around the country, major build-to-suits for the fulfillment centers that are, roughly 1 million square feet. We've now started to do some of the smaller infill locations for them. So it has been very beneficial to us. Amazon is a great partner, and clearly the proverbial 900-pound gorilla when it comes to e-commerce. We've also done some business with Walmart.com as Walmart begins to ramp up their business. So I would tell you the effect for us has been very, very positive. Those of you who sat in Jim Tompkins' session just before this, we've actually started now to see the practical application of these omni-channel distribution centers, where particularly retailers are distributing to their own stores, to other retail customers, and doing e-commerce out of the same facilities. And it's a fabulous model if you have an opportunity to get out into the markets and see some of these, how these operate. And each business is very separate and distinct. When you talk about sending pallet loads and truck loads to major retail customers versus the e-commerce side where things are going out in onesies and twosies, and the equipment and the volume and the seasonality of it is very different. So it's been a great positive impact, I think, for our entire industry in this last run-up since the recession. So we're very pleased with it all.
Jim, why don't you just take a minute to introduce Duke Realty as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jim Connor. I'm the Chief Operating Officer with Duke Realty Corporation.
Thank you. Mike.
So I'm Mike Landy with Monmouth Real Estate, one of the oldest REITs, formed in 1968. Specialize in single-tenant net lease industrials on long-term leases to investment-grade tenants. Let me just zoom out and kind of give you my take on what really is taking place, piggybacking on the e-commerce speaker's remarks that I assume most of us just heard. Will Rogers has said years ago, invest in real estate because they ain't making any more of the stuff. And for the longest time, that was true. You'd find well-located land, invest in it, and it would virtually make money for you in your sleep. What's changed with the advent of microprocessors, digital technology, and the internet is that they are making more of this stuff. We just layered on virtually unlimited space on top of the physical space. And cyberspace is going to have true winners in real estate, and it's going to have true losers in the traditional property types. And you can now, he's talking about unleashing Alibaba on the world. And what he means by that is that you have virtually unlimited retail space up on the internet where rents are virtually free. And for brick and mortar retail, it's as you saw, the trends don't look favorable. Look at office buildings. You used to store in filing cabinets tremendous amount of space. Now you have clouds, virtually unlimited clouds. So for retail and office, it creates true headwinds. For industrial, it's going to be a great catalyst for growth. The economics for industrial, rents are $4 or $5 a foot. Annual retail sales through a warehouse will be $3,000 a square foot. Brick and mortar retail rents are $40, $50 a foot. Annual sales average $400 a foot. So the compelling argument has been the consumer's superior experience just from the convenience of their home, their smartphone, finding what they want and buying it. But the real estate economics are equally compelling. So I think we're all sitting in a good place with regard to e-commerce.
So I'm my name is Kevin Gorey. I'm with Pure Industrial REIT. We own about 14 million feet in Canada and now own 2 million feet of FedEx product in the U.S. And I would say that if you had asked me 5 years ago, as recently as 5 years ago, what do we want to own? I think it was very clear, 32-foot clear, 400,000 feet, 52 by 52 grid. I mean, the convention was set. And then in the last few years, I think the game has changed. And when I looked at the deal that we did in the U.S. with FedEx, I think it was a response to that trend. And if you look at the deal that we did, the one question we would get from people is, boy, they're paying $7, $8 rents. They're well above market. And we certainly didn't feel that way. What we saw was when you look at the real estate that FedEx occupies in response to the demand for e-commerce and home delivery, you're talking about smaller buildings on a lot of land and a lot of infrastructure on that land. And our job, a couple things. Our job is to invest in real estate and assess risk. And so what we wrapped our minds around and what we saw was that the rent was clearly a function of the land that they occupy. And what we liked about the deal, ostensibly, was you get a lot of land with a small amount of building. And what we like about that is the trends in distribution logistics are changing. And they're closer to the population centers than they have been conventionally, which is a good thing. And after 10 years, if the tenant leaves, you've got a lot of land to work with, so you have optionality. So there were a lot of things about the deal that we liked. But all to say, if you look at the way things are changing, our industry is really about the land and responding to emerging trends. And I think that's the sort of deals that we're looking for. And if you get in front of a tenant like FedEx and Amazon and the other leaders in e-commerce, you're going to be well served.
I'm Scott Fredrickson with WPT Industrial REIT. We have been around since 1977, but we've only been a public company now a year and a half. During that 30-some year history, we've always been recycling the less functional real estate in our portfolio in favor of the more functional real estate. So today, the average age in our 13 million square foot portfolio is 11 years, probably the newest in the REIT space. Our average clear height, which is an important metric in industrial because the tenants pay once for that square foot, and if they can rack 6 or 7 pallets high as opposed to racking 3 or 4 pallets high, it's much more efficient. Our average clear is 31 feet. Our average building size is over 300,000 feet, so we've got a big, new, high-function portfolio. So as a result, about a third of our tenants today are e-commerce companies, people like eBay and Amazon. About a third are third-party logistics firms, and about a third are consumer products companies, but even those consumer products companies have a fulfillment center next to their DC. So we're hyper-focused on the newest, most functional real estate in the U.S. We're in 12 markets that range from kind of Chicago and Minneapolis down through Florida and Jacksonville, and our tenants are pushing the envelope on trailer parking and car parking, and so we're continually culling the assets in the portfolio to maintain what we think is a pristine portfolio exactly targeted toward what's happening in the distribution and fulfillment markets.
Just to follow up on that thought, so in addition to just, you know, the pure traditional kind of deal metrics and, you know, when you're looking at assets, What other attributes of an asset are you looking at? And are these themes of e-commerce changing? You know, people have mentioned parking and things like that. You know, how are you looking at your, you know, from an acquisition perspective, the physical characteristics and the other sort of non-financial metrics differently, if at all?
So when we look at real estate, before we start running the discounted cash flow models and the Argus models, we always answer the same four questions. And the first question is it the most functional rectangle that you can build in the market today? And does it have all the metrics that we're talking about in terms of parking and column height or column spacing and clear height and everything that would make it the most functional piece of real estate today? The second is location. Is it located in a big distribution market, but not just in a big distribution market? We want to be in the best submarket. In industrial, that's an important distinction because sometimes tenants will want to be just across a river to get in a different state. If you're in St. Louis, you want to be in Illinois. If you're in Kansas City, you want to be in Johnson County. If you're in Indy, you want to be in Plainfield. So submarket's a very important aspect. So second question is location and specifically submarket location. Third question we look at is where are the in-place rents relative to market rents? Because we don't want to lose sleep at night over where our tenant rents are relative to market. We don't want exposure. If a tenant leaves in our portfolio, we want to know that there's upside, not downside. And then the last question is basis, because we're a basis buyer. We want to know that we're insulated from new construction by basis. And so if we're paying over replacement costs, that's a non-starter from us. So when we sit down and we look at any real estate purchase across the country, it has to meet every one of those four tests before we dig in and start running financial metrics. And they're absolutely foundational to how we buy as a company.
And so I think for us, I think the biggest change that we saw is the amount of employee parking. I mean, if you look at industrial real estate, parking ratios for employees has never been a factor. But these new e-commerce facilities actually employ a lot of people, despite having a lot of automation. Like the FedEx facilities, the workers, so all those cube vans that you see around the city, they're actually parked on the site. And the employees leave them there overnight and then come back in the morning and pick up their trucks, which they own the routes for as contractors, and then they deliver the goods. So I think that was a factor for us that had not been evident before, is the amount of employee parking. And so that means, again, you need a lot more land for these facilities than you did before. And listen, if we're the smart, as industrial guys, if we're the smartest guys in the room, we're all in a lot of trouble. So we try and keep things very simple. And again, if you have low site coverage and you have a lot of land, you have optionality, you have the ability to respond to emerging trends, which is very important. But I think that was the biggest thing, is the amount of employees that actually work in these facilities versus the conventional warehouse distribution product.
Well, with Monmouth, you know, we tried to look ahead of the curve. Where's the path of progress going to be in the future? We started investing with FedEx in 1992. They're our largest tenant. We own about one in every five FedEx ground facilities in America. This was before the internet, and we believed in Fred Smith and his team and the hub and spoke distribution method that they employ, and it's just been a great relationship. And in addition to FedEx, all our other tenants are investment-grade tenants like Coca-Cola, Anheuser-Busch, Kellogg's, Caterpillar, United Technologies, Siemens, Sherwin-Williams, et cetera. So, you know, we sleep well at night. Perhaps there's a better risk-adjusted investment model out there, but in our 44-year history, we haven't found one, and it's very conservative philosophy. We look at location. It's a key factor in real estate investment. We like to invest where the job growth is, where the population growth is. Invariably, that takes us to tax-friendly climates like Texas. We have big concentration in Texas and Florida. It's ironic to me that the lowest cap rates can be found in California. California comes out in the bottom when they assess annually business-friendly locations. It's highly regulatory, highly litigious. And I think with the Panama Canal coming online, you're going to find already you're seeing major corporations locate along the Gulf and the Eastern Seaboard, and we've been ahead of the curve in concentrating our portfolio accordingly.
I agree with what the other guys have said. The only comment I would make, particularly as it relates back to the e-commerce discussion we had earlier. You know, a lot of these facilities have become somewhat specialized with a lot of material handling equipment in there. The point that we are always trying to convey to our investors and the analyst community is we own the underlying box. I don't own all the fancy equipment, which may be in vogue and state-of-the-art today and may be scrapped tomorrow. I don't own that. I own a good underlying piece of real estate that might be 40-foot clear, it might be 36-foot clear, it might be cross-dock, whatever the case. We're just looking at, you know, at the underlying real estate and not all the other specialized stuff. And I think, most of the panelists up here and most of our peers have maintained that level of discipline. You will see from time to time some people stretch and get a little crazy. And if that's risk that they want to take onto their balance sheet, God bless them. We wish them luck, but not in our world.
And Kevin said it best, Heather, with the... It's the site coverage, which is the big challenge today. And outside of what Jim's talking about, some of the, call them regional DCs for Amazon, while there are plenty of those, and Duke certainly has done the majority of them, there's a lot of e-commerce in your basic warehouses. And when you're trying to build these standard rectangular boxes, Kevin discussed, there's an added issue today, and that is you do need the parking for the delivery fleet at night. You need the parking for a 3 to 4 times the employee count that you'd ever done in the past. And you're doing this as you try to get in closer to the population where land is expensive. That's very challenging. As long as there's merchants out there that will pay up for the land and build a box corner to corner, it's hard to compete for more of the long-term players to build something that they think will sustain themselves through e-commerce and beyond. When I think of, certain sites that, in particular, that I think will be successful for us, when you're getting closer to the population base, it's not just on the inbound, it's the outbound. I promise you that for every 3 deliveries to a home or to a condo or to an apartment or to a dorm room, 2 are going back. And that's the unseen challenge, both from a logistics perspective and a technology perspective, that is really putting the burden. And that's what put the burden on UPS last year at Christmas. It'll put a burden on everyone who's trying to challenge UPS to be the driver in this e-commerce position. But you got to get closer to the population. Land is expensive. You need less coverage, not more. We've got to work cut out for us.
In terms of the economics of the deal, I think one of the interesting comments was about the change that's going on inside of these centers, which is now much more retail-like. And if you look at how retail rents are set versus what guys are getting on industrial, is there an opportunity there if you are facing some of these challenges of, more expensive land? What's the sort of pushback level in terms of switching the dynamics on rent?
My guess is it'll be what's always been true, and it's hard for us to execute. And that is, the way to push your rents is to know your client and know your client's business and know his options. If you think location is that important, as most of us do, you should be able to build the right product, the right location, and you know the business, you should be able to underwrite increasing rents. And you're right. Everything's morphing, right? It's the omni-channel. It's whatever buzz term you want to use. But there used to be small warehouses. Then there became really And a lot of the warehousing was done at the manufacturing site. Then we went to an import-based economy, and we built big DCs with little manufacturing. Then those DCs shrank a little bit because we were building big box retail stores, which were, in essence, a DC. Now they don't have room to do multiple channels of distribution from there. They can't do the brick and mortar, the brick and click, and the e-commerce all in one day. So it's all changing. I don't know really how you adapt to it other than you basically, you go back to your basics. Nothing in our side of the business has changed dramatically. It just needs to be tweaked a bit.
Maybe I'll chime in here and see if there are any questions from the room.
Paul, could I just add something to what's been said? The only thing it hasn't been stated but touched upon briefly was the holiday season. Now that industrial is the new retail, so much of the consumption takes place between October and January. And somebody mentioned UPS got caught flat-footed this Christmas. They didn't know that sales, if anybody should have known, it was, you know, UPS, but they underestimated the power of e-commerce and had this high-class problem of too much demand and not being able to deliver packages on time for Christmas as they guaranteed they would. I'm sure with all the expansions going on in light of e-commerce, they'll be, I hope and I anticipate, ready for this holiday season. But the point is that industrial distribution and fulfillment centers may employ 50 people for 8 months of the year, and in the holiday season, it could become 500 people. So you have to be near a part-time labor pool as well, because so much of the activity takes place over the holiday season.
And so how does that change the real estate requirement? You have to park for 500, yeah. even though you basically use 50 most of the year.
Yeah.
It has to be ready for peak demand.
I think the good part of this, and it maybe it's been said before, is one thing we struggle with in our business is more than any other real estate class, industrial has been viewed as a commodity. It represents less than 5% of the cost of our tenants running their business, but yet they don't see a value as much as we do maybe in location. That is beginning to change. I can tell you the last two deals we have looked at on the development side for one of our tenants, they have moved land prices for us to get the deal done. And that's something that that's a dynamic we have not seen in our business. We welcome it because we've always seen the value. One thing I've always struggled with is when the price of oil and gas goes up, they're willing to go, 25 miles out of town. And that has to have a cost in terms of transportation. It has to affect your business. But they've never really viewed it that way or put a value on it. Now they're beginning to, for other reasons, because what has been mentioned here is the fleet. And getting to the population, so land has become less of a restriction on getting deals done, and that certainly is a welcome development. No pun intended.
Maybe I'll just continue that thought. And the question is same day delivery using the same infrastructure as overnight delivery? Is same day kind of a game changer in the industrial space?
I mean, I think. The ideal building can be sliced up, right? So if you've got a good rectangle and the trend of same day means more decentralized warehouse locations, closer to population centers, but you've got a flexible rectangle that you can divide smaller, but it's still got the functionality to have cross-docking capability in the parking, then you're set up well to accommodate that. I mean, Louisville, we've got an Amazon moving into a center in Louisville right now. One of the other nice things about our business is the tenants, to Jim's point earlier, spend a lot of money to move into the buildings. I mean, Amazon's spending more money moving into our Louisville building right now than they're going to pay us in rent over the entire seven-year period of time. eBay, when they moved into our Kentucky facility, spent $40 million moving into the building. And so when it comes time for those leases to renew, you've got a little more pricing power because they're literally not going to move across the street to save 40 or 50 cents. But in Louisville, you can deliver to UPS's Worldport, which is their logistics hub where all the airplanes fly to twice a day, as late as 2 a.m., and they can still have it on the customer's doorstep by noon that same day. And so things like development near those air hubs, Indy for FedEx or Memphis, and then Louisville for UPS are important for that same-day delivery. But I think the key in our business is to have rectangles that are super functional so you can develop, so you can slice and dice them based on what the trends are.
I think I see a question right there.
We're all talking about the big boxes, but what about going the other way? I mean, you all also have some smaller multi-tenant spaces, maybe not as functional as it used to be. Just the thought of the following, like a biomeds example, or those kind of industries, going to the tech hubs, the Waterloos, the Canada, wherever, San Fran, and say, listen, we'll give you, as a startup location, these small places so you can play with your business and then grow with these guys as they start, as their businesses become successful. Is there a possibility of using small space like that?
Well, I'm sure there will be other more informed opinions than mine here, but definitely I think infill development has always been a play in industrial, in Canada anyways, because it's more difficult to develop in Canada than it is in the U.S. I remember when Target came up to Canada, we were talking about DCs. They thought we meant distribution centers, and we said, no, we mean development charges. And they thought, well, what the hell is that? And well, put it this way, a municipality will charge you $400,000 an acre to actually build a building in their area. And that was an enlightening moment for Target when they came up to Canada. So infill has always been a play in Canada, I think, more than the U.S. But a short answer to your question is, yes, it will become more of a play. We have looked at more infill development. At the end of the day, you have to tear down the building and rebuild it. And there is somewhat more specialization in the business going forward. That being said, I agree with what Jim said. We own the box. We make sure that the box is as functional as possible, and then everything inside it is owned by the tenant. But that's when you have to make sure that the site coverage is right. If you have high site coverage and specialization, and that tenant moves out, you have a hard challenge replacing that rent. But if the site coverage is low, you have more optionality to respond to what's changing in the market. So that's a very long, drawn-out answer to your question. But, yeah, infill is becoming more of a play now than it did before, for sure.
Well, I might answer a little differently. Infill development is a big piece of all of our respective businesses. I think to get to the point of your question, I think is, are we interested in doing smaller spaces, incubator spaces, going after startup companies and niche companies and things like that? Speaking personally, that's not a product type that we're interested in or focused on. We are much more to the other extreme. We want bigger buildings. Our personal opinion is, you know, bigger buildings get bigger, better credit tenants. They have less CapEx over the long haul and just perform that much better. I'm not in a position to be able to underwrite startup companies and biotech companies and things like that. I think there's a niche in the real estate world, public-private partnerships, private equity guys that are much better suited to do that. We're looking to invest in good core long-term real estate that's going to perform, as opposed to some of the higher risk stuff.
So you mentioned, development charges, and I thought that's a good segue to talk about supply. And, I mean, it's not only about e-commerce. There is, you know, kind of the bread and butter of your businesses. Maybe if each of you could, we'll start with you, Neil. Just talk a little bit about, you know, the supply-demand dynamics and whether you think that there's, you know, sufficient demand to be supporting.
I don't know of any supply, for to mention. We're pretty comfortable right now. I think it's watched closely. I think supply has become a buzzword. Not a buzzword. It's become a hot topic in the last quarter or two, maybe three. Rest assured, it's something we have to watch every day, and not just when we're launching a new development. We've got to watch it for our leases rolling in 14 and 15 and 16. We've got to watch it for an acquisition with maybe a short-term lease. So it's something that is constantly coming at us, and it's down not just to a city level, because we can get lost in statistics. Our business is really big on 50,000-foot statistics, and that's very ironic when the business is nothing but local. And so we dive down in the submarket, then we'll dive down in the size, and we'll measure supply versus demand. That being said, everywhere it seems to be okay. Dallas and Houston are probably out there as pretty visible on a whole lot of supply. And I'll tell you, rents are still growing in Houston, and absorption still taking place in Dallas.
By the way, is anybody surprised Texas is the leader?
It's kind of like Calgary.
Go big or go home, right?
Yeah.
But Texas, it is, you know, the Houstonians will tell you everything's different this time, and you say, whoa, wait a second. But I think there are some demographic changes this time. I don't think in the various oil booms throughout history it's caused a mass influx of residents the way this time around has. And so we're seeing it as, I got a 200,000 square foot building divisible into 50s. And this is a pretty much a true story. You've got an oil services, then you've got an elevator company, then you've got a flooring company, and then you've got an HVAC company. So it's kind of ironic, and it caught me, is the oil services are really why we all go to Houston. But the population growth has caused the office building construction, the multifamily construction, which needs the elevators and needs the flooring and needs the carriers, the HVAC guys. So, you're starting to see it's a little bit different down there. So Houston and Dallas, I'd say, would be the hot spots for supply concerns. At the moment, we're pretty comfortable.
Yeah, I would echo Neil's comments. You know, most of us spend at least some portion of our one-on-ones yesterday and today talking about supply. You know, just a couple of macro points. Depending on whose data you use from any of the big services brokerage firms, there's about somewhere between 100 and 110 million square feet of spec under construction or in the pipeline across the states. That compares to the high watermark back in 2007 of 165 million square feet. So just on a macro level, as Neil said, I would tell you that we're all probably in pretty good shape. We're not nearing the craziness of those days. There are a couple that are probably a little ahead of themselves. Dallas has been picked on a lot. There's a couple of second-tier markets that have probably pushed the edge, but all the Tier 1 markets are actually in really, really good shape. If you look at the amount of space compared to the size of the market, net positive absorption that we're seeing across the country. We'll see when the third quarter numbers come out in about probably 4 weeks. But, all indications are supply is very much in check, and, everything looks pretty good for the next 12 months.
I'm just going to chime in here, so to take an alternative point of view. So if we look at industrial REIT performance this year in the U.S., it's a laggard. And so what, you know, the market may be telling us is that all of the growth that is expected from development, you know, primarily from new development, is not as valuable as we previously thought. And so, you know, as stock investors, what we look for is kind of the second derivative, if you will, the rate of change. And so are we improving at an increasing rate, or is the rate of improvement decreasing, if you will, or rate of growth? Yeah. So that is the real...
Well, I'll tell you, the guy sitting up here think the glass is half full, not half empty.
Yeah.
I would tell you, you guys aren't seeing the value of the development pipeline and the rent growth in the existing markets.
So all else being equal, is the value of your development pipeline increasing or decreasing today as we sit here?
Oh, I would tell you it's increasing.
Yeah. And I think
One second.
You got this?
Go ahead, Michael.
You got this one?
You go ahead.
Supply and demand has never been better. It's the key thing to look at. And if you look at supply, there's 12 billion square feet in the U.S. Normal new construction has to be 1% just to keep up with obsolescence. So that's 120 million square feet. We've been, for the last 6 years, building 50, 60, 70 million square feet. So we're undersupplied, just all things being equal. But all things aren't equal. The industrial space is getting 2/3 of our nation's economy, consumer spending. We've merged with retail. We've acquired retail. Retail is no longer spending money on brick and mortar. You talk to the shopping center REITs, the mall REITs, they're becoming entertainment centers, which is a euphemism for restaurants, gyms, service centers, things that are impervious for e-commerce. As far as consumer goods, trillions of dollars, if you were in the e-commerce speaker's presentation, that's the demand coming our way. So supply and demand is overflowing. Little supply, enormous demand. You could zoom in on markets. You could zoom in on past 12 months. But if you take a step back and zoom out, things have never been favorable. And this is a generational shift. So you're going to see, if you look at Alibaba, retailers aren't even building brick and mortar in China. They're just going to Alibaba. They're bypassing construction altogether. He's got 80% of the market. And industrial's the new retail. So that demand coming our way, 2/3 of our nation's economy coming our way, you can't underestimate it.
I'm very happy that Michael stopped me and answered that question. That was a very good answer. But from an investor perspective, I think personally what we felt is if there is a real estate investor for REITs and they're looking across real estate asset classes, I think one thing when they look at industrial is it has a short development cycle. So it can respond to demand very quickly. It can build when it needs to, and it can stop when it needs to. And so what you get from that is you get very steady growth, but you don't get 10% growth. Like, rents are not going to go up 10, 15%. So I think sometimes you get the retail office investor that looks at industrial and says, oh, a 4% NOI growth, you know, ho-hum. But I would challenge them to say, okay, in this environment, where are you going to put your money in the next 10 years? So I think I'm kind of answering, I'm trying to answer your question there. I think part of it is just wrapping your mind. We're in a low interest rate environment. We're going to be this way for a lot of years. And when I look at our business, I think it's very good, but it's very steady. It's not, you're not going to get a 10, 15, 20% growth.
Fair enough.
So then, quick survey, and since we have this high-tech app, which is going to be raise your hand, would you be developing now? You're talking about this, you know, game-changing shift. Is it time to develop? So maybe talking about that, if you're sort of looking at capital allocation, you know, development, asset sales, acquisitions, where's your mindset at in terms of that?
And maybe as a follow-on, can you please tell us if the returns on your development are increasing or decreasing? Compared to last year?
I'll go first, Heather. I think if you're doing your job right, there's always a time to develop. Okay, it's either with an existing customer or a customer you can provide a better solution for, a better location, all the things that we talked about. And to add to Michael, which is hard to do, but to add to his excellent comments, we're also starting to see the resurgence of some manufacturing. And I know that's been headlined, and people wonder, why is that? Is it just natural gas? Is it just transportation costs, environmental costs, supply chain? But think about this. We're talking about ordering consumer goods off your telephone, which hopefully none of you are doing right now as we're speaking. But then if it's imported from Shenzhen, it's 49 days to get here? I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? So you're going to see a lot of forces cause, to a point, some manufacturing resurgence in the United States. What are they going to do? They're going to take industrial space. So I do think it's an added dimension that we haven't yet seen on the development front, but I know we're seeing it on the leasing front, because the number one leasing markets I have this year are Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Louisville. And that includes Texas and Chicago. So there is something happening. It's a lot of smaller stuff. I do believe it's related to local manufacturing. So I do think there's a time to develop now, and there's a time to acquire, maintaining below replacement cost thresholds. And to answer your question as written, there's always a time to sell. And it's everyone is hitting on all cylinders today.
Yeah, I guess I would tell you that we are very, very active on the development front. We have shifted virtually all of our acquisition dollars into the development pipeline. We found that pricing around the country, doesn't matter whether you want to go to Southern California and look at 4.5 caps or go to, you know, the Midwestern markets and look at 6 caps. You know, we're struggling with pricing for good quality product. We don't see the value add. We have plenty of development opportunities, both on the build-to-suit and the spec side. So those dollars have been shifted into, you know, all into development. And, you know, with pricing being where it is, we're actively pruning our portfolio, trying to take that bottom 10% off, like we're all trying to do on a regular basis, and take advantage of some very good pricing.
And so how much of a lift would you be getting over acquisition cap rates on your developments?
I would tell you across the board, on average, you're probably 150 basis points. More if you're doing spec, if you're underwriting it correctly, probably 200 basis points on spec.
Well, I'll jump in. I think Neil's comment on manufacturing is an important one, because as big as e-commerce is, and it's a huge story for industrial, the re-onshoring of manufacturing jobs for our nation's economy is the biggest story. We're now the world's largest producer of energy resources. We're producing 12 billion barrels a day of oil equivalent. We consume 18 billion barrels a day. It's tremendous amount we're producing. I should say a million barrels a day. So we're seeing manufacturing come to Texas with Toyota. BMW to South Carolina, GE to Mobile, Alabama, Boeing to South Carolina. So a lot of manufacturing is coming up, and industrial demand is spilling over on that. It's job growth, it's economic growth, it's energy independence, and hopefully increased national security.
Certainly on the development side, I guess the short answer would be yes. The long answer is if you can't acquire it, you need to build it. And to what's been stated before, we're seeing in our markets you can build probably closer to 100 basis points over what you can acquire for. But that's with a lease in place. So that's very attractive to us to grow with our existing tenants that we know is very attractive, but also to respond to emerging trends. Our business, like more than any other, I think, deals with obsolescence, and you have to respond to obsolescence. And so we sell non-core assets, as has been mentioned, and we also develop to build the product that meets that has the functionality for the current trend. So I think in our business you have to develop to be successful, and what you need is you need a stable of tenants and relationships that you can leverage to develop successfully, and I think that's crucial for our business.
The only thing I'd add is I think we've covered development well. There is still an opportunity, albeit cap rates that are approaching where they were at the peak in industrial to acquire, and that is where you can find assets that have rents that were reset at the trough of the market. So if you're paying a 6.5 cap, even though that might have been what you paid at the peak, but the rents are 50 or 80 or a dollar below where they were at the peak, you're still buying the assets below replacement cost, fully stabilized with, in many cases, investment-grade tenants in place. And if you're a basis buyer, that still makes sense. We bought 3 million feet last quarter.
All right. Well, thanks so much. We're out of time, but thank you for a great discussion, everyone.